From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, October the... what is it today, Dana? It is, okay, it's October the 16th. I lose track sometimes. October almost already half over. That's amazing how time flies. October the 16th, 2019, and we have an excellent, fully packed show for you this morning. Later on in the second hour, we're going to be talking with Attorney General T.J. Donovan, who's been getting into a little dust-up over access to public records and whether when his office produces public records and somebody wants to capture them or copy them using their own equipment, like a smartphone, just to take a picture of a document, for instance. Can the Attorney General's office charge for that? The governor now says no. The Secretary of State says no. We're going to find out whether the Attorney General is sticking to his guns and saying, continuing to say yes, as he was last week on that question. A little later this hour, we're going to be talking with Dennis Moynihan. He's with a new effort to rejuvenate the College of St. Joseph down in Rutland. It closed back in June. They're going to return it into an innovation center, an entrepreneurship center for that part of Vermont. And we'll be learning all about that from Dennis Moynihan in the second half hour of the program today. But first, I wanted to bring in, this is quite exciting. I'm very happy to say we have on the show this morning Vermont's newest Teacher of the Year. That is Elizabeth Biba Khan. She's a Spanish and French teacher at the Main Street Middle School, a school dear to my heart and near to my home. It's only about maybe less than 100 yards from my house in Montpelier. And my kids went there, and so I have an affection for Main Street Middle School and everybody who teaches there. And I'm happy to say that the teacher there just won Vermont Teacher of the Year. And Elizabeth Biba Khan is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning and congratulations.
Good morning. Thank you.
And this is quite exciting news. Stephen Mills in the Times Argus has a very nice write-up this morning in which I thought he actually really captured the excitement in the, I gather it was in the school gymnasium where you were having an assembly about this yesterday?
It was. We were, you know, over 350 kids packed in there.
And the yes, crowd went wild.
As middle schoolers are wont to do, yes.
Yeah, that is cool. I mean, that's just a great bunch of energy in that building there. And, of course, I get the sounds of the middle school band wafting through my porch occasionally. So that's all for the good, too.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the program there. So kids are starting Spanish and French in middle school. Do they do that even earlier in Montpelier now?
So our middle school starts in fifth grade, and mm-hmm. students start taking foreign language, French and Spanish, sort of an exploration course with me in fifth grade. In fact, I just dismissed my fifth graders a couple minutes ago.
Wow. So
yeah.
That's great. I mean, the earlier the better with foreign yeah. languages, right?
Yes, exactly.
And are you finding what's more popular, French or Spanish?
You know, we're pretty evenly split, and depending on the year, you know, sometimes French has a few more students, sometimes Spanish has a few more students. Vermont is, I think, pretty special place in that way, where both languages are really useful and valued. So it's great.
Yeah, that is interesting. Obviously, we have a strong French Canadian heritage here, and as well, many, many new arrivals who speak Spanish as their first language have moved into the state in the last 20 or 30 years. So
exactly,
we're
yep.
kind of at a crossroads here, and so you are in kind of an ideal spot there, I would think, just as far as linguistically, culturally, and all that sort of great stuff.
Yeah.
Another question I like to ask teachers when I have a chance to talk with them is, occasionally you'll run into a student who just comes across initially anyway as not motivated. I remember kids in my middle school and high school classes who would, you know, sit in the back row and flip quarters off their elbows and joke around with their friends and not pay attention and et cetera, et cetera. What do you do about that when you see that?
Right. Well, it, you know, I think it depends on the student. I think one of my core beliefs is that there are many, many reasons why students are unmotivated,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it has nothing actually to do with your curriculum or your teaching methods. They're deeper seated, and so I think one of the ways that you reach out to those kids is that you show them that you see them, that you value them, and that you're committed to their learning, and you know that you're going to sort of help them figure out what they need in order to make progress. And then you you know, keep after them about it. You know, you follow up. You know, it helps also to plan fun things to do in class and engaging lessons. Trying to tailor your curriculum to student interests is another way to sort of engage kids. In foreign language, the cultural component of our subject is so fascinating, and that's sort of an inroad for a lot of students. But it's really dependent on the student, and, you know, it's about, I think, but at the bottom line, it's about showing them that you care about them and that, you know, you're going to keep after them until they get engaged.
Yeah, that's got to be a tough, and I would think on a personal level to the teacher, sometimes a little bit frustrating if you have a kid who's an especially, you know, hard case of inattention, and you know, and kids can be kind of defiant about that too sometimes. But I guess you know, your job is to bust through that, right?
Yeah, and I think you know, a lot of kids bring, you know, are overcoming a lot of obstacles in order to be at school and access their education every day. And I think to think about, come at it from a place of empathy and not judgment, I think helps me and others, you know, be less frustrated and more, you know, sort of curious about how we can help the student, you know.
Yeah, well,
make progress.
And if you could take a kid who might be, you know, kids oftentimes have a path through school which sort of builds on itself either in a good direction or maybe a less good direction sometimes. If you can try to steer them well onto the tracks and get them to a place where they are making progress, really from any level to the next level up, that's the whole game, right?
Yep, motivation is driven by interest, and then feelings of competence. You know, the more we feel we're good at something, the more we, you know, and more effort we put into it, you know, so
just
getting
a little
virtuous cycle going is important.
Yeah, that's very important. A little background on you. You grew up in Montpelier. I think I was mentioning earlier when we talked on the phone briefly this morning.
Yes.
Your brother, Peter Walk, has been a guest on the Dave Graham Show a few times. He is Deputy Secretary of Natural Resources, so quite an accomplished family. You traveled around some. You were living in other parts of the country for a while?
Yep, I have lived in San Francisco and in Baltimore, then also in southern Vermont, down in Brattleboro.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
And been at the Main Street Middle School about 5 years now, I read.
Yeah, this is my sixth year teaching.
Wow, okay.
Yep. Here.
And Main Street Middle School, I got to say, now has two teachers of the year. I have a good friend, Karen Heath, who got the award when she was teaching in Barrie a few years ago, and just this year started at the Main Street Middle School. So
yep.
She's
an awesome colleague to have and has been such a support through this whole process.
Yeah, that's tremendous. So you guys have pretty powerful batting lineup now, I guess, is one way to describe it over there. So that's great. Hey, Elizabeth Bibikon, congratulations again.
Thanks so much
for taking a few minutes on the Dave Graham Show here this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Have a great day. I wanted to bring in Steve Pappas, good friend of the Dave Graham Show, occasional host, frequent guest, and Steve is the editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. And I was just borrowing liberally from your paper this morning. Not to say it's an overly liberal publication. I don't want to go there, but to talk to Elizabeth Bibikon there at the Main Street Middle School, Vermont Teacher of the Year.
Yeah.
And that's pretty exciting news for your
local
community.
Definitely a great honor.
Yeah. And I was saying Main Street Middle School now has two teachers, at least. Maybe there are more there. I don't know whether there are. Actually, I should have asked about that when I had Ms. Khan on the air here. Quite an honor to get that award. And if I recall correctly, I should have asked about this as well. I wanted to cut the time a little bit just so we have more time with you, Steve. And these teachers actually get to travel to Washington, as I recall. There's a ceremony at the White House.
Yeah, that's right.
One from each state. So
yep.
That would
and
be,
I believe it's they end up going, it's both the Teacher of the Year and the Principal of the Year, I believe, go down at the same time.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. I could be wrong about that.
It's pretty exciting stuff, really. I mean, I think it's many teachers are incredibly hardworking and dedicated to the work they're doing, and it's almost kind of sad that, you know, it's only one that gets singled out on this annual basis. because there are many, many others who probably just missed the award, if you know what I mean. But certainly it's quite an honor when one does get selected. So there you go. That's some exciting news for Montpelier today. And Steve, you had a very interesting op-ed column that you ran in today's paper. Also, I got a huge kick out of it. It was the Mark Aubrey piece. He's kind of your humor writer, I guess. Is that fair? Is
he your... Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what he... I think he would say that. And, you know, sometimes I have to... sometimes I cringe when I read it, but he has a good following. And, we used to toggle between... Yeah, my op-ed page today is all about dogs and cats, for the most part. A little bit of dentistry. But, Mark... He and Burr Morris used to toggle back and forth for years. One on Monday, and then the other the next Monday. And then when we stopped publishing on Monday, we had a hard time finding a place for those guys because we would get kind of stockpiled on op-eds. But yeah, Mark is he often writes about humor. He avoids politics kind of at all costs, except to poke fun at usually terminology in politics, which is, you know.
Right. Today's piece, I noticed, is all about cliches. In fact, it's just one cliche after another for 600 or 800 words. It's really rather more cliches than Carter has liver pills, or you might say, or... I must say it was a kind of an admirable piece of work here, and I try to avoid cliches in my own work here, unless I'm sort of making fun of them or something, and or occasionally I'll try to twist one up. You know, I was writing about hippies a few years ago, and I said they were fit to be tie-dyed, and so, you know, you can have fun with cliches occasionally. One I think needs to be updated, though, because of inflation here. He talked about betting dollars to donuts. Last time I checked, a Dunkin' Donut is 99 cents. So, you know, the cliche about dollars to donuts probably sprouted up when donuts cost a quarter or something. And so we have to figure out a way to redo the math or something on that one. But anyway, that was a fun column by Mr. Albury this morning. It's nice to give him a shout out about it. What the heck?
Well, I have to add to the shout outs. Yesterday, the Merriam-Webster word of the day was belfry. And the example that they gave several examples with the definition, and one of the examples was a story written by Stephen Mills of the Times Argus.
Wow.
So he got a little worldwide attention yesterday as the proper use of the word belfry in a sentence.
And help us out here. I missed that one. I'm not sure why or how, but I what is the proper use of the word belfry?
Well, it was, now you're going to make me look it up. It was in the context of a church, so it had to do with the, you know, the structure. He was talking. His sentence was describing the renovation that was done to a structure, in which the bell, I believe, had been removed at the time, but the belfry was still very much intact.
My understanding is the belfry is just the kind of it's the part of the steeple, the small chamber, smaller than the overall steeple, where the bell itself hangs, and actually that's the space where the bell is located. So,
exactly.
And if you have bats in your belfry, then maybe you need to put up some screens on the steeple of your church or something.
Yeah. Well, I did point out when I sent around the note to all the staff about Stephen's little moment of glory, his 15 seconds of fame.
Yeah.
he did use it properly, but that all the bats were definitely in his belfry. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, that's a that actually is reminds me of a favorite story that I did once, where I went down to Windsor, I believe it was, and there was a church right there on Main Street that kind of stands above the whole village there, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's a congregational church, and they were doing a renovation of the steeple there. This is now probably 25 or 30 years ago or something, but just a fascinating trip up the narrow little staircase into the belfry and the steeple of that church. And that's quite a an art and a craft in Vermont. Of course, we have the steeplejacks based there in Plainfield, Jay Southgate, who's got quite a regional reputation around New England now, and maybe other parts of the country, even as somebody who consults on steeples and does the work to renovate them and get them into shape. It's a tough spot to be in here, very exposed to the weather up there if you're a steeple. And yeah, it takes a lot of painting and a lot of replacing rotten members and all that kind of stuff to keep those things up and safely way up in the air there. So that's that always struck me as a fascinating kind of a thing. Maybe one of these days I'll see if he can come on as a guest and tell us, how does one become a steeplejack these days? Is there a school for that, or you just have to find an old master to study with?
Good old fearlessness, yeah.
You have to be not worried about heights, that is for sure. That is because you're typically, when you're doing that work, you are way up there. So,
Dave, did you watch the debate last night?
I started to watch it, and then I got sidetracked with a conversation in the family and kind of lost the thread, actually, I have to confess. So I didn't. But I was noting that, one of the big storylines, which I, came on pretty early on, was with Elizabeth Warren kind of ducking the question about how do you pay for Medicare for all.
Yeah.
And I think this is a question that has been around in the debate over health, over sort of publicly funded healthcare in many different iterations over time. I remember hearing the same kind of debate when Governor Shumlin was proposing what they were then calling a single payer or universal healthcare system for Vermont, and his argument was, and I'm not sure why she couldn't go there, because it is pretty well rehearsed by now. But basically, you say to people, okay, right now you're paying, say, $400 a month in a premium taken out of your paycheck, because that is your share. The employer may be picking up 70% of your health insurance costs, and you pick up 30%, and that 30% equates to this $400 a month deduction. Typically, let's say you get paid every couple of weeks, so it's half of it out of one paycheck, half of it out of the other. Presumably, in a Medicare for all system, which is all handled by the government or some government agency or whatever, that $400 deduction from your paycheck disappears, as do the copays and deductibles and other parts of the health care costs that people typically face when they actually use the system. And so there's a big subtraction there from your monthly, yearly costs or whatever for health care. And then you add in a tax increase, which offsets some of that savings, and you kind of see where you come out in the end. Bernie Sanders has made this argument, and it says the average American would come out ahead, would actually face lower costs for it. But Elizabeth Warren seemed not able or willing to spell that out as clearly. I'm not sure why, because, that clearly would have to be the case. What do you think, Steve?
She nibbled around the edges of it, and she gave a very general overview of what you just described without getting into a specific example, and basically said that middle income Americans would ultimately save money, but it did not. She did not do a, I think everyone knew that she was going to somewhat come under attack, but I didn't feel like watching it that she did a very good job of kind of distinguishing herself from the attacks and from the field yesterday. I was a little surprised. I felt like she was kind of lukewarm.
Yeah, everybody has an off night now and then, and so I guess that was hers, and it could be she'll recover and do better in future debates. But I think on that one, should be an easy one, frankly, to basically be able to say for any politician, listen, I'm not up here to tell you fantasy stories here. I'm up here to tell you how a practical change could make some improvement in our current situation. Let's look at healthcare. You know, if you don't like the way it operates right now, if you think that too many people are left by the side of the road in terms of getting good care, if you think that your own family is, you know, on the verge of bankruptcy because of your medical bills, maybe you do want a different kind of system. That's the appeal of Medicare for All, and that's what we hear from some of the other candidates, and certainly from universal healthcare advocates over the years. But I think you could actually score some credibility points just by saying, and yes, your taxes will go up because this is a publicly funded program, and publicly funded program typically are funded with taxes. But your other costs will disappear. So, you know, if you want to decide really just based on the dollars and cents whether you like this or not, figure out how much you pay in your monthly premium, what your average annual copays and deductibles are, and do the math and figure out whether you think this would be a savings for you or not. I think that would be the most honest way for a politician to describe this, because it's just, frankly, it looks like it's true. And then once the politician does that, then voters will say, well, at least they're dealing straight with me. You know, they're fessing up. So,
well, and you just outlined what Bernie has been rehearsing for years now.
Yeah, that's true. Well, hey, Steve, we are about out of time this morning. I really appreciate you joining me as always, and let's do this again soon.
Sounds good.
Steve Pappas, editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. We'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show after the bottom of the hour news break from CBS.
Fall. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing into the second half hour of this program on Tuesday morning, October the 16th. I'm sorry, Wednesday morning, October the 16th. I'm having trouble with the date this morning, 2019. And I get my calendar correct here. Maybe I'll call WDEV's calendar girl and see if we can get some help there. But anyway, in the meantime, I've got a caller on the line this morning, a special guest. Dennis Moynihan is with the Vermont Innovation Commons and has been working with folks at the closed College of St. Joseph in Rutland to try to figure out the future for that campus. And this is a really tough time for many small Vermont colleges. I believe we've had three of them close just this year. And, you know, one question that will pop up after something like that happens is you've got some nice buildings there and a campus, good facilities for a wide range of uses. What do we do? And it sounds like the folks who are interested in the future of this campus have some ideas. So, Dennis Moynihan, thank you very much for joining us this morning to talk to us about what some of those ideas are.
Dave, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
And tell us a little bit about the College of St. Joseph is actually now officially defunct. It's no longer going to be a college, correct?
Well, not quite. That's really where this began. As you said in your opening, three colleges earlier this year essentially closed: Green Mountain College, College St. Joseph in Southern Vermont.
Yep.
But the other two closed, but the College of St. Joseph said, you know, we don't want to go down. They lost their accreditation for financial reasons, but they thought, how can we reimagine what we deliver? How could we stay here? They've been a big part of Rutland for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what really got us together. It was the state of Vermont introduced us, because we're looking at the same topics. And that's what's led to this project over the last several months of doing a feasibility study to reimagine, you know, how the college can relaunch education in a non-degree fashion, not accredited, but focus on workforce development and the kind of things that people need in this area. And at the same time, bring a lot more to that campus, which, as you said, has a lot of beautiful resources. Bring more so that you have an integrated solution that is a new business model for what, you know, what you call a defunct campus and what colleges are facing all across America. Bring a new business model for making them vibrant again for the 21st century.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to describe as the breaking off or the jumping off point here is that the college won't any longer offer like undergraduate majors and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The traditional model, they lost their accreditation, and you know, colleges, you know, all across Vermont, all across the country, the business model for these smaller liberal arts nonprofit colleges doesn't really work anymore. There's less people, they're over capacity, expensive to deliver. So they're not going to be doing that. But the question is, how can they continue to serve the community in some new way that maybe makes more sense?
So talk to us about what is on the horizon here. It sounds like there's some exciting stuff in the planning here, and describe to us what folks have in mind.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this builds off of sort of the best practice going across the country, all over America, in big cities and particularly in rural America. You see communities creating what are called innovation centers. It's centered on providing co-work facilities for people who need an office space or working from home, but they need an office space. But it can involve, you know, a lot of other issues in terms of supporting startup businesses, et cetera. And that's what we're doing together with the College St. Joseph. The idea is to create this integrated center that uses the real estate and the great space that they have available for classes that CSJ and other partners can hold, but also a co-work space. There's a beautiful library that can host well over 100 desks, small offices for businesses starting up. We can offer programming for startup companies, incubation, acceleration, the kind of mentoring that companies need. We can do workforce development, and we can hold events that create a vibrancy, a buzz. We talked to the young professionals in Rutland, and they said that's one thing that helps keep young people here and moves more young professionals in, is having that kind of big city buzz in a small town environment.
Yeah, you like that. I think one of the downsides I've heard over the years to folks who work at home, I mean, they love the fact that they don't spend a couple hours a day stuck in traffic, but they can sometimes feel pretty isolated and like they aren't having that that just casual bump into somebody at the water cooler or the coffee bar, where sometimes great ideas get created or bounced off of somebody and that kind of thing. And it sounds like this co-worker space could be a sort of a rejuvenation of that idea. I think there's a word, propinquity, if I recall, which is just the notion of being close together.
you're absolutely right. I mean, and one of the things that Vermont made some national press with a program to attract remote workers. And while that, wasn't big numbers, the point is remote working has become huge across America. One of the things we highlighted in the report we did is that there's more and more companies that don't even have a headquarters. They have thousands of employees, but they're spread everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And if you think about it, what a great thing for somebody to live in Vermont, to be able to live in our great lifestyle, in rural Vermont, but be able to work anywhere in the world, have a job in Seattle or have a job in Texas or have a job in Singapore for that matter. But you're absolutely right. It's really hard to do that when you're isolated, you don't have the connections, and creating this kind of a space, help people be much more productive. And those workers are plugged into it's not just a desk. They're part of all that activity going on. They're meeting a lot of other people. They're meeting startup companies. They're seeing the workforce. They have access potentially to a maker space. So there's a lot more they can do. There's one other piece I want to mention. I've talked to women professionals who are working from home across Vermont. And one of the things they say is that they like working independently, but they often, if they have to take a business meeting, they have to do it at a cafe or a coffee shop or a restaurant or bar.
Yep.
And that's kind of uncomfortable sometimes. And so they really like to have a professional place to take meetings that's professional and safe. So there's all this kind of knock-on benefit to creating a good space.
Yeah, I know that in some cities, you know, large cities or small cities, there are facilities that you can actually go in and just occasionally rent an office, for instance, for, you know, almost by the half day or something, have your business meeting, and then but not be tied to a big monthly payment for office rent, because as you put it, you might be working from home the rest of the time or just be out on the road or traveling or whatever. And is some of that going to be on offer here, the occasional office kind of thing?
Absolutely. You can get a day pass. You can just come in. Also, too, the desks are used in a couple of different ways. You can have a membership, a lot like a gym membership, and that means you can drop in whenever you want and use a desk. You pick one desk that's free. But if you're more regular, you want to work in the place pretty much every day, you can also sign up for a dedicated desk. And that it's still one of the desks in the open area, but that one's always going to be yours. And you can put a picture of your special person up there or your puppy or whatever you got, and that's your space.
Yeah, well.
You know, there's one other thing about this place that I didn't mention that I think makes what we're talking about fairly unique, is because we're using a college campus, it not only includes the office space, but it will use the dorms and repurpose them as co-living space. And that's to allow people who are engaged in the center to have a place to stay that's close to, you know, part of the working space. So let's say there's a group of people who are going to be going through workforce development, and they have to be together for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They can come live on campus, even if they're spread all across Vermont. It's a place where they can be more convenient. Also, if a professional wants to move into Rutland, they get a job and they want to come, they can soft land. They can take one of these spaces, have the desk, have the space, have everything taken care of for 3 months, 6 months while they're, you know, finding a place that they want to buy or live. So it really adds an angle to this, and I think it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, that is an interesting. I mean, the very short term. I remember years ago I was down in the Boston area, and there was a building in the neighborhood where I was that actually catered to musicians, and they would rent out these little offices, studios by the hour, and people would come in there and practice, you know. And so,
yeah.
You know, there was it was fairly near the New England Conservatory and the Berklee College of Music, and so there were a lot of musicians around looking for places to practice who maybe felt like, for whatever reason, they couldn't in their homes or apartments or whatever. So that this building offered that service to folks. I don't remember exactly what they charged per hour, but it was some nominal fee, and you'd go in there with your saxophone or your trombone or whatever, and you were allowed to make as much noise as you wanted and go crazy, right? You know, so
absolutely. And you know, people are more flexible today, particularly younger people. They expect to have flexibility. They're happy to work in other places. They mix work and life and play all together. Sometimes they've got two or three different jobs that they're working on,
mm-hmm.
and so they're much more not only accommodating to that, they really prefer that kind of a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's that flexibility and that ability, that idea that you're not completely tied down to any one thing is something that seems to have an awful lot of appeal when you're 24 years old or something like that. So, do you feel like there's a critical mass of population in the Rutland area that will actually, you know, take advantage of this new space or reconfigured space and make it economically viable?
Sure. The short answer is yes. I mean, that's a big part of the detailed studies we did. But that's, you know, that's the challenge with Rutland. That's the challenge with Vermont, is that, you know, we're not a densely populated place.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked under the covers. You know, we met with a lot of people who expressed an interest, but we looked at census records, for example. And if you look at Rutland and the surrounding counties, there's over 6,000 people who identify themselves as work at home occupations. Now, you know, of course, that's a wide range of things that people may not need a desk. It's also some of them are too far away probably to make a daily commute. But that gives some sense of sort of, you know, under the radar, how many people, you know, are out there. So we planned, you know, accordingly for a slower ramp up, because it's not Boston, it's not New York.
Yep.
But we think that the numbers are there. And the other thing is that the space isn't all just for workers. One of the biggest things about this is that we want to support startup companies. And Vermont has a growing share of startup companies. But what's important is This center is in a federally sponsored, state-identified opportunity zone, as is much of Rutland. There are three opportunity zones in Rutland.
Mm-hmm.
That's, if your listeners don't know, that's a program that came out of the recent tax overhaul. It's a bipartisan initiative that's trying to get people who have capital gains, it gives them a tax benefit for investing in local communities, particularly communities that have economic and social challenges. And so every state got to identify 25 of these opportunity zones, and Vermont did. And so that can unlock investment, not just in the real estate, which is what's happening across the country, but in companies that either start or grow, move to and grow in an opportunity zone. And so, you know, we looked across New England, and if you just look at the kind of companies that would be seeking a significant investment and are young enough to be flexible, there's over 700 companies that fit that bill just in New England, and many of them will move to a place if it can unlock, you know, real money, a Series A investment, $1 million, $2 million, $3 million to help their company grow.
Right.
So we think that part of the demand for the space will be the companies either starting here or moving here to take advantage of that.
I wanted to find out a little bit about some of the organizations behind this effort to find a new use for the campus of the old College of St. Joseph in Rutland. What is Vermont Innovation Commons, first off, Dennis?
Sure. Vermont Innovation Commons and Vermont Works are two organizations that are sort of connected at the hip. I'll start with actually Vermont Works, and then it's easier to explain the commons. Vermont Works is a social investment fund here in Vermont. It's about attracting investment from across the nation to invest in companies and initiatives here in the state that make a difference, that play to Vermont's DNA of sustainability and resilience, renewable energy, ag tech, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so all across the country, the social investing is a big part of it. The Vermont Innovation Commons is sort of a deployment arm for Vermont Works focused on creating place and space. And so how we got involved in this is that we're working on creating a space in Burlington, Vermont, that does a similar sort of thing. But really, it's about wherever in Vermont we might be able to create a physical presence that can help companies start, help people reskill, etc. So that's what it is, and that's why the state, you know, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development knew we were doing this, knew that the College of St. Joseph was looking for its next act, and put us together.
Now, I remember in the last year or two actually reading a nice story in the media somewhere about a makerspace in Rutland, and I wanted to see if, does that fit into the picture here anywhere?
It could very well. The makerspace is called the Mint, and it's really great. It's a couple years old, and they've got a space in Rutland, but maybe a little bit out of the way. It's sort of on a dead-end road, and it's grown leaps and bounds. They have jewelry making and woodworking. If your listeners don't know, a makerspace is where people can sign up and actually have access to all this sort of professional equipment if they're a woodworker or a metal worker or want to do 3D printing. And so Mint's been great. We've been in serious conversations with them about moving the makerspace or expanding the makerspace onto the CSJ campus. And the reason why is a lot of people, it's actually through that physical maker activity where they sort of start their own business. And it makes sense to have the business training and the maker facilities close together. Now, there's a lot that goes into that. We've got to figure out about the economics of moving it and the engineering of moving heavy equipment onto the campus.
Mm-hmm.
But the stakeholders and Mint and we are seriously talking about how that might work. And no matter what happens, we're definitely going to be supporting each other.
Yeah, again, I mean, it just strikes me that there would be some nice synergy there, and something that sounds like you're both sort of pushing in the same, in similar directions, maybe not exactly the same direction, but it sounds like there's a, like the old Paul Simon tune said, why don't we get together and form ourselves an institute, or call ourselves an institute, I think it was.
Exactly. So. Well, you know, part of the thing with people doing stuff is there's a lot of programs in Vermont that help startups help entrepreneurs, young people when they're thinking, or women who want to get into tech, but often they're disconnected. And the idea is that you want to help people through that entire journey, from the time when they're just got a twinkle in their eye about something they could do, to being a solo entrepreneur, to actually forming a company, to actually getting a product, to actually growing the company, actually hiring staff. That's a long journey. And the more you can collaborate, the more pieces you can bring together, the more you can help people all along that path. And that's kind of the idea.
That is really very interesting. And I think it's an exciting thing. It's, obviously a sad thing when a college closes and no longer is going to be doing its traditional undergraduate programming and so on and so forth. But it sounds like people were kind of chomping at the bit to turn a crisis into an opportunity, as the Chinese proverb says. And
Let a good crisis go to waste, as they say. Never let a good crisis go to waste.
There you go. Well, Dennis Moynihan of the Vermont Innovation Commons, I really appreciate you joining us this morning to fill us in. I want to have you back in a year or so and ask you how it's coming. How's that sound?
I think that sounds perfect. We'll come back, and I'm sure we'll have a spring in our step and a smile on our face. That's
all right.
Our plan.
Okay, that's the plan. We'll be checking. Hey, Dennis, thank you very much. We're going to go to a top of the hour break very shortly on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and we're going to be coming back to talk with in the second hour some with one of our CBS News correspondents. Then Attorney General T.J. Donovan joins us, and should be some interesting conversation. Maybe we'll get a chance to open the phone line some and hear from some listeners out there as well. So stay with us, folks. More to come on the Dave Graham Show on this Wednesday morning.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we continue into the second hour of our program on this Wednesday morning, October the 16th, 2019. Want to welcome Mike Lyons, a CBS News and military consultant, to our air this morning. Talk to us a little bit about the situation in the Middle East right now, which is not a good one, it doesn't appear. And Mike Lyons, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to check in with you to find out a little bit about, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence are planning, or actually heading to Turkey today to try to meet with President Erdogan there and prevail upon him to stop the invasion by Turkish forces into northern Syria. Is that right?
That's right. And there's concern as to whether or not Erdogan will meet with them. He first said he wouldn't, but then there's been press conferences that said that he would. I think this will send a signal to President Trump as to whether or not the Turkish president is serious about his requests of stopping the offensive operation. I don't think he will, though, given the way he's used his military right now. He's trying to get as much land as he can. He's well inside of Syria. He's about 50 kilometers inside of the Syrian border, all along the northern border between Syria and Turkey. Mm-hmm. And he's looking to root out what he considers terrorists in cities like Kobani and places that are Kurd strongholds there. And we have to see, reports are coming back about humanitarian crises, but we have to see what exactly is going to be the result of this.
Yeah, boy, that would be kind of an embarrassment if these two heavy hitters of the U.S. government travel all the way to Turkey and are rebuffed and told they're not going to have a meeting with Erdogan.
I would think so, given how the president has been tweeting and how the president has been talking about this. And he kind of lost the narrative in the beginning of this. It's been going on 8 days now, this offensive operation, but he lost the narrative with regard to us backing away from the Kurds, who really aren't our allies. Let's also put this in perspective. I mean, our only ally in here is Turkey. They're a NATO ally, and that's won by congressional approval and Senate oversight and the whole thing. They're the only real ally here. Now, it's clear the past few years our relationship has gone south. But that shouldn't matter, and we should try to figure out a way to fix that one first. When we put troops instead of Syria under the Obama administration, I guess about 6 or 7 years ago now, we didn't think about an exit strategy. We didn't realize how we were going to get them out of there. That wasn't the thought. And knowing full well that we were aligning them with Kurds who the Turks considered mortal enemies of them. So we're here in a certain way because of decisions that were made 7 years ago. And the president, trying to keep a campaign promise, wants to pull all the troops out.
Yeah, I it's a tough thing to spot for the United States to have gotten itself into, regardless of whom you might blame. And it seems as though you'd want to withdraw, if you're going to withdraw, very, very carefully and in a way that actually provides some security guarantees. You know, don't you negotiate a little before you just announced we're standing down immediately? I mean, is that the normal course of events, and why wasn't that done here?
No, it should have been, but diplomatically, we don't know really who to talk to. We don't have good relationships with anyone in the Syrian government because, again, of the previous administration, and you know the mantra of the, you know, Assad must go, and we're drawing red lines. So we didn't set up any kind of relationship there. And to say diplomatically, to try to get the Kurds and the Turks together, well, people have been trying to do that for 100 years. And perhaps this is going to force now the diplomatic response. But I'm afraid, though, that the offense operation will continue and there will be more lives lost, because from a military perspective, Erdogan is smart enough to know, he's getting enough advice to know that you got to keep going and get as much land potentially, and then you negotiate that back at the end.
Yeah. Now, if President Trump were for instance to wake up tomorrow morning and say, "Boy, maybe I shouldn't have done that," is there any way he could extract himself and reverse this situation now, or was it basically a one-time decision? And once you're off the cliff, you're off the cliff.
I don't think he's reversing it. I think if anything, you're going to see the 1,000 other soldiers that are in Syria in the southern and eastern portion of the country there. That are fighting against certain ISIS remnants, as well as really protecting what's considered a land bridge. There's a road system that goes from Iraq through Syria into Lebanon there, and the Iranians are trying to use that to shore up the Lebanese in terms of the PLO and the terrorist organizations they fund there. I think you're going to see those troops out. And again, let's think back. Did anybody even realize we had this many troops in Syria to begin with? It's a sovereign country that we never declared war against Syria. They were put there on executive order. And, if Congress wants to declare war against who would be Turkey at this point, that's not, I don't think that's a good idea either. But I think the president's initial instincts are right to get us out of these places and try to figure out a way to get the sides talking. I mean, Russia's already there. That's not an issue of we've ceded the vacuum to Russia. They're already there to begin with. They've got a warm water port in TARDIS in Syria to begin with. They've always been a Syrian client for the past 50 years already.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Russian situation doesn't really seem to be changing that much. I mean, the only change for them is just that we're not also there effectively at this point. So, I don't know. Unless they start to launch some kind of an offensive there themselves, I mean, is that happening, or is there a sign of that coming?
Well, they don't have that much capability there. They have air fighters, and they've got certain things, and that's why people are calling for a no-fly zone right now. I don't think there's any air defense capability out there other than handheld surface-to-air missiles. And you can see the standard answers that analysts have. Oh, we're gonna put a no fly zone in there and that's an act of war. If you do that, you're gonna be shooting down potentially Russian planes, even Turkish planes. I just don't know if we're willing to do something like that now. So I do think while it was ham handed and there was lives lost over it, not American lives for sure, but I do think the president's instinct is correct about getting out of there. And it seems as though, we have this issue of we put American troops in a place and then we can't figure a way to get them out of there because, if we leave, the people that we think that we're fighting against are going to come and take it over. I just, this has been going on for 40 years. It's a self-perpetuating problem that, the president, I think, in a good way, is trying to break the cycle of that.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't really be a surprise. Turkey and the United States, as you said, allies historically, both members of NATO. Can the Turkish-U.S. alliance survive this? And if not, what does that mean for NATO?
It's not just that. And if Turkey leaves NATO, that would be a real, that would be the win for the Russians, and that would be something that we have to be concerned about. Think back to the mid-60s, though, when the French decided to leave the military arm of NATO and kick the NATO headquarters out of Paris. And so, you know, NATO's been through some ups and downs before, but, mm-hmm. but NATO's got to, if this is forcing NATO to also reinvent itself or to stay relevant, I think that's important as well. I mean, I think Trump has put pressure on the NATO allies in order to start funding their operations. I mean, the Germans, for example, have the most to lose in a ground war in Europe and are the most underfunded in terms of what they provide to the alliance should the Russians decide to unleash 400,000 troops on Western Europe. I mean, I know these are somewhat unthinkable situations, but everybody, you know, that's how we got to wars in the past. You know, they start at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, NATO will have to, you know, NATO's putting pressure on Turkey as well, sanctioning them for some of their military things. NATO has decided to buy certain aircraft defense platforms, the SA-300s and 400s from the Russians, which is in directly because of us working with the Kurds. This is I'm not trying to put too much blame on the Obama administration, but the Obama administration made decisions that were all about, you know, high moral ground and, you know, bending the arc of justice and all this other mumbo jumbo. But the bottom line is, the realpolitik of it is, it forced our allies to do certain things that we didn't want them to do.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's a mess. Let's see if we can extract or somehow put out this fire, because, boy, it sounds like an ugly situation. Mike Lyons of CBS News, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and it's good chatting with you. Hope we can do so again in the near future.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to being back with you.
All righty. Got on the line with me this morning, Attorney General T.J. Donovan. And Mr. Attorney General has been a bit on the hot seat in the last few days over his decision last week to say that folks can inspect public records at his office. If they have a public records request, the office will produce the records. But if the people want to take pictures, say with their smartphones, of a set of documents that the office has provided, then there's a charge for that. And there's been a little pushback now from both Secretary of State Jim Condos, Governor Phil Scott, and wanted to get the Attorney General on the air here this morning to defend his position and tell us what the thinking is behind it. And Mr. Attorney General, thanks so much for joining us.
Dave, thanks for having me.
So tell us why, if I come by your office and I make a public records request, I want to see your documents related to, you know, the EB-5 scandal, just for one example, and you find some documents and you say, okay, here, you can sit at this table and look at them and take as long as you want, you know, although our office closes at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, whatever it is, and you can inspect them, but if you make copies, then we're going to charge you. But I'm making copies on my own smartphone, which I paid for. I pay for the electricity to recharge it. I'm going to maybe transmit these photos I take of these records to another device that's also mine, or maybe my boss's or something. Why is that a cost that should be recovered by the Attorney General's office?
Sure. Well, Dave, thanks for the question. And the short answer is this, because that's exactly what the Vermont Supreme Court said. This is not T.J. Donovan saying it. It's the highest court who has the final say about the law in our state, and that's exactly what the Vermont Supreme Court said. Now, let me explain. And here's, I think, we have to expand this conversation just from public records more to taxpayer dollars. What do I mean by that? Now, it doesn't matter who makes the request to our office. We treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. But the question is, should the Vermont taxpayer be reimbursed for legal work that is done? Over half of the requesters to our office, Dave, are outside law firms and businesses. In fact, one organization that I would say is a climate-denying organization, we had to produce over 13,000 emails. Now, unlike any other office in state government, we're a legal shop. So we have to vet every piece of paper to see whether or not there's some sort of confidentiality privilege, attorney-client privilege, or whether or not there's a court ruling that impacts releasing something. It's a lot of legal work. And so the basis of the Supreme Court opinion is, hey, if the requester is going to take something with them, then it's a cost that is reimbursable. So I don't think Vermont taxpayers want their tax-funded lawyers, the Attorney General's office, doing free legal work for corporations and outside law firms, Dave. I'm standing up for the Vermont taxpayer, you know, these other guys can talk about saving a nickel to Jane Q. Citizen, but that's not the case here. So let's talk about the real facts.
Well, let me go to the costs here, because you talk about the office facing costs to do the legal work of reviewing these documents and finding out which ones can be released to the public. Okay, and do I understand correctly that the court basically took off the table the ability of the office to charge for the staff time it takes to generate these records? Do I have that right?
Not exactly. The best way to look at this is what the court said is this: if Jane Q. Citizen or John Q. Citizen wants to come in and inspect, to come in and physically look,
yep,
there's no charge. That's fine. We don't dispute that.
Yeah.
What they said is, if you want to take a copy, and they define a copy, I'm going to quote from the case, that a requester could keep and review wherever and whenever the requester chooses. So it doesn't really matter if it's coming from your phone or somewhere or our copy machine. If you take something with you, what the court said is, then those costs associated with getting that document ready for copying are reimbursable costs. And I think, you know, this is unfortunately being framed as, well, this is infringing on the media or the citizenry. You know, the fact of the matter is, those are the minority of the requesters to our office. The majority of the requesters to our office are outside law firms and businesses. Should Vermont taxpayers be funding their lawyers to do free legal work for law firms and businesses that have adverse positions to our state? Last time I checked, I think climate change is real. I think we have to do everything to address global warming. I'm not sure I want to do free legal work for an organization that doesn't think climate change is real, Dave. And I don't know where the governor stands on that, or Secretary Acondos, but that's what we're talking about. So advocating for is to talk about the facts.
Yeah, okay. So what I'm trying to establish here, though, is that your office is going to do some work, some staff time, and I understand that you're going to devote some staff time to you have to have somebody go to the filing cabinet, pull the record, look at the record, and say, is this record releasable to the public, or does it have so much material on it that is you know, covered by various exemptions to the public records law? Maybe it's somebody's, you know, tax return or something, or maybe it involves somebody's medical records. Who knows what the case may be? But I mean, there are well accepted exemptions to the public records law, things like tax information, medical information, that sort of thing. Okay, so you need to have somebody in your office actually look at the document and say, is this releasable to the public? Okay, that's where your main cost is, right?
Well, the cost is lawyer time, because it's not just look at the document, it's engage in a legal analysis in the context of pending litigation,
yep,
orders from the court, investigations, privileges, other privacy protections, and confidentiality. It's not just does an exemption apply, it's the larger context of engaging in the legal analysis of a case investigation, taking into account court orders and rulings.
Okay, and the underlying public records law, which says that if the thing can be released, it must be released. I mean, that's in there too.
That's right.
So now the determination is made that the following 7 out of the 10 documents requested are releasable, and that the requester can inspect them. So you bring them out to the room where the requester is sitting at a table, and you put the documents down on the table. You have incurred your office has incurred all of its costs at that point, and the only additional thing that might happen is the inspector, the member of the public, or your the other law firm, or whoever it is the person sitting at the table pulls out their smartphone and starts snapping pictures of the pieces of paper. Does that add additional cost to your office's work?
That's not the question, Dave. The question. Is what is the law? What did the Supreme Court say? The Supreme Court said if the requester, you, takes something with you, then those reasonable reimbursable costs can be applied.
Yeah.
That's what the Supreme Court said, and I'd ask that you actually look at the case and have people look at it, because it is in black and white.
Right, and I understand. You know, my interpretation of that really went to, there is a cost if I ask your office to make copies of a document. Let's say it's a 50-page document, and I say, hey, can you make me a photocopy of that? I'd like to take it with me. And you've got a copier there that's using electricity and ink and toner and wear and tear and et cetera, and you want to charge me, you know, 10 cents a page for the copy or whatever, that strikes me as reasonable.
Dave, with all due respect, you have it wrong. That's not what the cost the court is talking about. What the cost the court is talking about is the legal work engaged in the legal analysis to vet every piece of paper before it's ready for production or inspection. It's not the cost of the 10 cents to make a copy and plugging in the copy and the electricity. It's the cost of staff time, lawyers, which pick a number, $100, $200, in Burlington, $250, I don't know, $50, doesn't really matter to me.
But did the court
cost is the lawyer time.
Did the court say that when you allow a member of the public to inspect these records that you can charge for lawyer time? Or was it only if the person wants to actually take something with them?
It's only if they want to take something with you. Let me give you this site on page 4.
Okay.
Well, listen, Dave, you're laughing, but you're laughing at the Vermont Supreme Court.
I think they got more work to do, frankly, Mr. Attorney General. I really think the court needs to revisit this and tell us what they actually meant, because don't you logically here, the court is saying for the person to come by and inspect the records, you don't charge them even for your lawyer time and so on, right? All they want to do is the person wants to only come by and inspect the records. They don't get charged, right?
Let me first say this. I don't believe in disparaging courts. I think far too many people in today's politics do that. I won't do that. They're the highest court in our state.
No, I understand, and you have to appear before them.
I respect the ruling. The clarity, there is a need for clarity.
Yeah.
We can get that through the legislature, but this is an interpretation of black-letter law.
Okay.
This is black and white. There is no dispute. Now, the other side is saying, well, it really comes down to the word request. I mean, listen, that sounds like Bill Clinton talking about the meaning of is.
Well, you know what? We got to figure that out on the meaning of is on the other side of the break here, because we got to go to some CBS News.
All right.
Oh, actually, I'm being told I got a minute and a half to go here, so I'll let you finish this answer here. I mean, I guess I think we're at a maybe sort of a logical, not so much a legal impasse, but a logical impasse here where I understand, you know, your analysis of what the court is saying, but it just strikes me that if the court says you don't charge when the person just wants to inspect the record, but you do charge when the person pulls out their own smartphone and takes a picture of the record, that strikes me as, whether it's the court or the legislature that needs to put more work in here, somebody does, because It's not a cost. It's not an additional cost. I understand that you say your office has costs, legal analysis costs. Okay. So, but we'll have to talk about this more after the break. I'm sorry.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, and my guest, T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General of the state of Vermont, and T.J., thank you very much for staying with me through the break. I don't know that we're going to resolve this question. We're kind of going back around and around on this question of the charging people who want to, no charge to inspect the records, but if you want to take a picture of the record, there's a charge there. That's the bottom line, right? T.J. Donovan, are you with us?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Are you okay? Sorry about that.
Sorry. Look, Dave, I'm for making sure taxpayers are protected in this state, and mm-hmm. that the state's law firm isn't doing free legal work for positions with for firms and businesses that have adverse positions to our state.
Would you like a situation where the where you were allowed to charge for access to these records, even if the person actually is only inspecting?
No, it doesn't really, you know, look, that's what the court said, that the court said, hey, you want to come take a look free of charge. We don't have a problem with that.
Yeah,
okay. If you're going to take something of value, presumably these documents, then yes, you get charged, and those are those reimbursable costs for staff time, which in my office is legal work. Now, here's the thing. Here's why I think there's some tension on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously this applies across state government. But my office, being the lawyer for state government, is uniquely situated to deal with this issue because any sort of litigation or investigation is coming through my office. So you call Commerce and say, hey, give me that contract. Well, there's not any staff time that's going to exceed 30 minutes. So there's never going to be a cost, and probably shouldn't be. In my office, we're spending hours.
Mm-hmm.
We're spending hours every day doing this. Because that's our job. Now, yes, the public has a right to access public records, but I also believe our clients have a right to be represented and defended. And that's going to create some tension. So, look, Dave, I get your point about the logic, and I think what we need to do is get it in front of the legislature and bring some clarity to this. That's
okay.
All I'm saying.
But, hey, TJ, we got a couple callers on the line. I'd love to have them get their words in edgewise here. So let me, if I could, go to Paul in Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, TJ. Good morning, Dave. Hey, TJ, first of all, I take a little bit of offense in your comments to Dave about, you know, possibly disparaging the court system. I think what Dave's little chuckle is the same one I had, and it's just incredulity that we're surprised at how complicated this is when it really seems quite simple. And there's a definition of what the meaning of take is when you talk about a copy. But the second comment I wanted to make is this. I appreciate your concerns, but you're trying to single out climate change deniers is a non-starter with me, only because it's not what the group represents. It's the fact that they are a group within Vermont, and these lawyers are representing probably somebody within Vermont, whether it be an individual or a corporation who do pay taxes. And for that fact, they need to look at documents, regardless of what they represent in terms of topic, you know, pro or con, should have no bearing on this situation.
I disagree with you.
Well, TJ, the Public Records Act is neutral as to who the requester is, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So if it's a climate change denier group or if it's VT Digger, the reaction to the request shouldn't be different based on who it is, should it?
It shouldn't be different, but it gets back to the cost. And should we be doing free legal work for position for companies and law firms that are going to have an adverse position to our state who are engaging in pre-suit discovery, Dave? It's a strategic move where we're paying the cost for people who are going to end up in a lawsuit with. Why should Vermont taxpayers be doing that?
Yeah,
answer that question for me. Why should the Vermont taxpayer provide free legal work for companies that are going to sue us? Oh, tell me.
It's apparently this is what the court said when it said that these adverse parties who are going to sue you can come in and look at the record, inspect the records, and for free. So, you know, that's what the court ruling said. Now,
Dave, play this out logically. But if they're going to take something, the documents that they can later use in their pleadings.
Mm-hmm.
In their filings against their state, there should be a cost to that, should there not?
Well, I mean, here's the thing: is that occasionally in my career as a reporter, I've inspected a record, and I have actually memorized a key phrase or two off of it, and used it as a quote in a story. I mean, sometimes what'll happen is I'll memorize the key sentence fragment. Write it down as soon as I leave the office. I remember doing this once in an elevator, you know, it just so I wouldn't forget. And then I have this key sentence fragment to be quoted in my story, demonstrating that there's a certain state policy change on X, Y, or Z, right?
Yeah.
And there's a case where I just went in and I inspected the record for free. And yet I did extract some value on it because I got some material for a story, right?
Yeah.
And so I didn't pay for that, but I guess if I had, instead of relying on my memory, I had had a smartphone at the time and I pulled it out and took a picture, I would pay for that. Is that right?
If you took it, based on the court's ruling, if you took it with you, the photo, the copy, then, and it's, and I want to get back to this point again, unique, and I'm reminded of the saying, Dave, where you sit determines where you stand.
Yeah.
I think that's appropriate for this. We're a legal shop, so it's not the cost of the copy, not the cost of snapping the photo. It's the cost of the legal work associated with getting the document ready for inspection or copying. So I think we need to get away from this debate, frankly, a false narrative about the cost of a piece of paper or the cost of snapping a photo and the, you know, how much did it cost to charge my phone so it could take the photo. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the staff time. And again, it's in black and white in the case. And so this is the Vermont Supreme Court. And I'm not, look, maybe I'm acutely sensitive to standing up for our institutions in today's political climate. So, you know, no harm, no foul on chuckling. But the fact of the matter is here, let the process play out. The court ruled. This is their decision. Okay, yeah. we need some clarity. That's fine. So where do we go? We go to the legislature. Guess what? That's how our government works. So let's everybody take a deep breath, work together, and figure out a way out of this. But when it...
TJ, I want to get another caller on. I don't know what how much time we didn't actually get established how much time you were going to be able to give me this morning.
I'm having a lot of fun, Dave. I don't know if you are.
Oh, I'm having a blast, man. I'll tell you, I also wanted to shift gears in a couple of more minutes after this next call, I think, and talk about the gun law and the Max Mish case and all of that, because that's a big headline today too. Let's go to Bob in Plainfield and check in with Bob. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. My opinion is, and the last caller's check kind of hit on it, but listening to this conversation, the thing that hit me the most was when TJ said, pick out of all the people that take records, one group. And I don't think his job is, because he believes strongly in global warming, that he should determine that that's the case that should pay for the stuff. It's a farce. If you ask two lawyers the same question, you get two answers, different answers.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Don in Elmore.
Dave, good morning.
Dave.
Let me let TJ jump in here just for a moment here. What do you got, TJ?
Well, the previous caller is absolutely right. You ask two lawyers, they're going to get two different answers. And it reminds me of the line of President Kennedy, who said, I just want a one-armed economist, because you always get it on one hand, but on the other hand, you'll get a different answer. So, look, reasonable people can disagree on this.
Yeah.
All I'm suggesting is let government, the rules of our government play out. The court ruled. You have a lawyer make an interpretation. Somebody disagrees with it. Now we go to the legislature to get clarity. I don't see what's wrong with this process.
Let me go get another caller in here. Don from Elmore. I'm sorry, Don. Go ahead.
That's all right. I just think this is getting a little bit silly. And I say that in this respect. I understand TJ's feeling about the time and the effort put in to make a paper ready for somebody to come in and view it.
Mm-hmm.
But then just charging to take a photo of it, that to me is a little bit silly. It isn't as if they're having to make a copy right there in the office. They've already been told by the court that they have to make it ready and without expense. So that to me is a totally separate issue. The taking a photo of it and being charged to do it with their own camera, I think is a little bit off the wall. They could take the time to sit down and copy it by hand, and they'd have the same thing, and they would not be charged for it. So why should they be charged just to make it a little bit quicker and take a photo of it?
TJ, let me go back to that example.
Look, Dave, the caller makes a really good point, and frankly, the caller has just articulated the dissent in the court's opinion, which are, you know, it was a 3-2 opinion, you know, it's a divided court, but look, there are reasonable positions on both sides. And do I like, you know, saying you can't snap a photo? No, but in like most things, it's a lot more complicated when you dig a little bit beneath the surface, because it is the legal work, and going through 13,000 documents takes a lot of time and effort. And my lawyers, I think, should be focused on addressing the opiate crisis, making sure consumers are not getting ripped off, making sure we got clean water and clean air in our state. That's what I want my lawyers doing. I don't want them going through documents.
A little bit further, though, TJ. I hear where you're coming from about making this available to somebody who might use it to sue the state. But if the state's going to get involved in something that's a suit and they're going to be looking for this, are you not going to have to provide it under a discovery motion anyway?
Yes, we will in discovery. But my point is, I'm not sure I should be given documents up front to give somebody an advantage before there is a lawsuit in what's called pre-suit, before you sue, discovery. Why should I be doing the legal work for somebody who's going to sue us?
Hey, TJ, let me ask you about another thing Don just alluded to, which is that, and I'll go back to my example of memorizing a couple of key sentence fragments and leaving the office before I wrote them down. What if I were to actually pull out my notebook right there in the office while I'm at that table inspecting the record and start copying sentences down into my notebook?
That's a great question, Dave, and I think that's the question I'm most worried about, that we need the legislature to interpret what the court said and bring clarity. Because again, let me go back to the definition of copying that the court did. Okay, this isn't me, this is the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that it said this is I'm quoting from paragraph 8 of the decision. This language indicates that authorizing charges for, quote, a copy, the legislature meant a record that the requester could keep and review wherever and whenever the requester chooses. That's how the court defined a copy. So in your hypothetical of taking notes, would that fall under the definition of copy that you could keep and review wherever and whenever the requester chooses? Let's go to the legislature. Let's get clarity. Let's actually follow the process that we have in our government to answer these questions, as opposed to, you know, I'm okay getting criticized, but I'm just following the law here.
I wanted to shift gears now, and actually there's another headline actually this morning involving Attorney General T.J. Donovan, because his office right now is embroiled in a battle, let's say, unrelated to the public records law. This one is about Vermont's 2018 ban on high-capacity magazines for firearms. These are devices which actually store the bullets, and the question is, how large do you want them to be? A lot of gun control, gun safety advocates think they shouldn't be that large, because when they are very large, they help to provide sort of technically an ability to do a lot more shooting in a very short length of time. And so that's one of the issues that comes up a lot in gun control debates. Vermont has this new restriction on a ban on high capacity magazines. It's currently being tested in the courts by a case involving Max Mish of Bennington. He's the guy who got famous last year for harassing an African-American woman who was serving in the state legislature. She ended up deciding that she needed to resign her legislative seat, not run for re-election, to Kaya Morris, a very well-known and well-regarded, well-liked person around Montpelier, disappeared from the scene, much to the sadness of many of her colleagues, because she didn't want to put up with this harassment. And meanwhile, Mr. Mish gets picked up and charged with violating this high-capacity magazine ban, and now is challenging the constitutionality of that ban. And so, TJ Donovan, tell us about the current status of the case. I think there's a key phrase here, maybe interlocutory appeal. Is that a legalese phrase that we're using here?
Yeah, that's a legalese phrase, Dave. Basically what that says is that there's a question of law. It's got to go up to the highest court, again, to the Vermont Supreme Court, to answer that question of law and whether or not the legislation that banned large capacity magazines is constitutional. We believe it is. We believe it was common sense legislation necessary for public safety. We won at the lower court, at the Vermont Superior Court. Now you have that question, which then goes up to the Vermont Supreme Court. And really, that's the case. So we need, again, the highest court, the Vermont Supreme Court, to answer the question whether or not the large capacity magazine ban is constitutional. I believe it is. I believe that uh, you can you can pass reasonable regulations to promote and protect public safety. I think given the epidemic of mass shootings in our country, where oftentimes large capacity magazines have been used, that this is a reasonable regulation to protect Vermont's public safety. And we look forward to litigating the case.
Refresh me, has the case against Max Mission, you know, the underlying charge actually been adjudicated and now it's being tested? Or was the...
No. So basically what it does, because the case is that question of law, and so he filed the motion to dismiss at the lower court.
Yep.
The court ruled in our favor, basically saying the law is constitutional. And then, so the case is essentially put on hold at the lower court. Then the question, is this constitutional, goes up to the Vermont Supreme Court. So that's pretty much the easiest way to explain the legal procedural history of this case.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, interlocutory, inter just means get in the middle of, and locutory has to do with the conversation.
Your Latin's pretty good.
Hey, I went to Catholic school way back in the day.
Me too, but yours is better than mine.
I am dog 'em, have 'em, flee 'em, or something like that. And I play dominoes better than you do. Or anyway, but basically what it means is that we stop the case kind of mid game here.
That's right.
And you know, we ask Newark for a ruling. Was the ball out of bounds? Bad metaphor to sports there, but we're just waiting now for the Supreme Court to rule on this constitutional case, because basically it sounds like there's not much dispute about the facts of whether Mr. Bish had this particular item, and whether the real question is it allowed? And that's what goes up to the court now.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a question of law, not fact. If it was a factual question, who did what, when, where, how? That's not what's being disputed. It's a question of law. Is the legislation that was passed and signed into law, is it constitutional under Vermont law? We believe it is. I think there's a litany of cases, not only in Vermont, but of course across this country, which said, hey, look, you can pass reasonable regulations to protect public safety, and banning large-scale magazines are one of them. Again, we have to understand that the new normal, unfortunately, is that mass shootings are a real threat everywhere in this country. We had a close one. We had a close scare down in New Haven, Fairhaven, I should say. And these are just steps to protect the public. That's our job. And we're going to litigate and defend the law in the Vermont Supreme Court. And that's what we filed yesterday, was a brief that was in support of it. I think we had 17 of my colleagues supporting, fellow attorneys general around the country supporting our position defending the Vermont law. We had groups such as the Giffords.
TJ, I've got to interrupt you, unfortunately. I really appreciate you taking the time, but we are about the end of the Dave Graham Show here for this Wednesday morning.
Dave, always good to spar with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It is fun, and we'll talk soon. Hey, that's about it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayer, the Midday News Service, and all the rest of the great WDEV programming here on the stations of Radio Vermont. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our program.